Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Behind the Racket Pod, the podcast taking you behind the racket with today's top tennis players and biggest issues facing the sport.
Behind the Racket is a community to give fans and players in the world of tennis the opportunity to open up like they have never done before.
Visit BehindTheRacket.com for the latest stories, merch, as well as direct links to all of the latest podcasts. It can also be found on iTunes, Google Play, Pandora, Stitcher, and wherever you find your podcasts. Download the episodes and make sure to leave a review.
And we want you to be a part of the conversation. Find me at NoahRubin33 or Mike at MikeCTennis on all forms of social media. You can also learn more at BehindTheRacket.com or MikeCTennis.com.
Special thanks to my sponsor, New Balance. Visit their latest shoes and styles at NewBalance.com and learn more about their program of giving back at #NBGivesBack.
You can also help support the podcast by visiting patreon.com/behindtheracketpod and receive rewards from our travels around the world. And now.
Well, it's a pleasure for us to get joined by Somdev Devarman, and we should note that Noah is practicing. He may or may not hop by, depending on how his practice goes. But Somdev, thank you for joining us. I was just saying before we turn on the microphones here, you're wearing the Virginia Tennis shirt. I mean, those trademark Babolat shoes here that I remember so well from a few years ago. I mean, you don't look like you've changed in the least.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here. And in terms of, the Virginia shirt, I had to steal it out of Tret Huey's suitcase. The Babolat shoes, actually, I've had for since I've retired.
Really?
So, yes. So, they go back a long way. And the good thing is, I don't run the same way I used to. So, my shoes last me a lot longer than they used to.
You had an incredible collegiate career. A very, very good professional career as well. And for people who might not know, what have you been doing with yourself since you officially retired in 2017?
Officially 2017, unofficially, I mean, the last match I played was March 2016.
Right.
That's when I decided. I thought I'd, give it a shot, maybe 5-6 months off. Maybe I'd feel healthier. Maybe I'd want to come back. Maybe I'd feel hungry again. And when that didn't happen, 2017 was the retirement. But listen, I feel like I've done a lot. And I feel like I'm constantly busy. It's just one of those things. A couple of things that I have done. I had started a non-profit when I was still playing, trying to work with kids in India. That's still ongoing. And apart from that, right now I'm in Savannah with you. I was in Sarasota, I was in Tallahassee, and one of the things I'm working on is working with Sumit Nagal, who is young Indian player, not 24. You can decide if that's young or not. I let other
For
people
me, all
decide.
Of you are young.
working with him, he's just coming off a little injury and trying to make his way back. And he actually wears a little, my career high was 62.
Yeah.
So he wears a little thing on his neck. You can ask him about it. It says Project 61. And so I'm happy to be on his team. And I'm happy for him to try and beat my ranking, which no Indian has done in at least 30 years, I believe.
Yeah.
That's one of the things. Apart from that, I have done quite a lot of broadcasting in the last 4 or 5 years, all of it out of India. Started off with the Olympics in 2016, where I had a lot of time on my hands at that time, but then, continued with the same channel in India. I've done the Aussie Open for the last 4 years at least. I've done the Olympics, I've done Asian Games, and I'm looking forward to doing the French Open in just a couple of weeks. So between broadcasting, a good amount of tennis coaching, on my free time, I play music, working on an album.
No kidding.
Yeah, so singer-songwriter. And just, I mean, you know, honestly, when I stopped playing tennis, one of the things that went through my mind was, you know, there's a lot of things I've always wanted to do.
Yeah.
And if I don't do it now, I don't know when that'll happen. So number one was, you know, very lucky to be with someone that I was in love with. So got married and settled down and absolutely loving that aspect of life. But other than that, she was also very supportive about, you know, the thing is that a lot of the things I wanted to do weren't exactly lucrative. Yeah. So finding the balance between hobbies and a profession has been a challenge, but it's been fun.
So this music, and we'll get to the tennis here in a second, but the music, tell us stylistically, kind of what path are you going on? I know you were a big Dave Matthews Band fan. Is that the type of style?
Singer-songwriter.
Okay.
I mean, I'll be the first to say it. I'm not an incredible guitarist, but I'm okay.
Yeah.
I've gotten a lot better over the last 4 or 5 years because of the time.
Yes.
But I you know, I started off by writing a song about why I stopped tennis.
Really?
And how I stopped tennis. And the reasons behind it, at least emotionally for me, you know, I felt like there was no better way to communicate it. And that's how it started, one song. And then I realized that I have a lot of things I want to say. And sometimes it's just easier to say it through a different medium.
Yes.
Rather than, you know, get into a boxing match with something, with belief. And your belief versus other people's, and I'm not here to fight, man.
Okay.
I'm just enjoying it.
So we won't
it.
Have any debates here today.
we can, but they'll be friendly. You know?
So then, what was the reason for stopping? How much of it was body? How much of it was mind?
You know, I think one of the things is body had a part to play, undoubtedly. Yeah. I don't want to be one of those guys that said I stopped because I was hurt. You know, because I was hurt before. I came back from it. And broke the top 100 again after shoulder surgery. So for me, you know, one of the reasons, you know, I wasn't the biggest hitter of the ball. I felt like a big part of my game relied on, you know, not just the legs and the lungs and the understanding of the game. Obviously, that was a big part of it. But a big part of it was, you know, how hungry and motivated I was to come out there and fight those 30 all points and 15 30s and, you know, bring those points back. And, you know, after tough losses, the motivation I would have, you know, when I was on the track or when I was in the gym, you know, I felt like one of my strengths of my tennis, and this is obviously only people close to me would know, was how hungry you are as a tennis player.
Yes.
And I think that's a very underrated thing that people look at, because, you know, when you're looking at a match, you don't see the work that goes behind it. When you're looking at a career, definitely you can see a little bit more, but you know, that was one of my strengths. And I said it before, but you know, I felt like that motivation was dwindling a little bit, and you know, that's not good or bad. It's just what it was.
Yeah.
I had different interests. I was, you know, growing up, and you know, I was 30. I was still growing up.
Yeah.
You know, I was a veteran on the tour, but there was a lot of things in my life that I felt like were taking my attention away from. The full attention that it had from the time I joined college, even before that, till the time I stopped, you know? And so once that starts getting lower and lower, and once you don't want to train the way you used to, or once your body doesn't also allow you to train the way you used to, then I never felt like it was fair for me to expect the same kind of results that I wanted to have.
Yeah.
And honestly, you know, I didn't, no disrespect to, you know, guys that are out here grinding. I love the grind. That's why I'm out here again. And I see the different battles that people go through. But, you know, I felt like I really I wanted to be in the top 100.
Yeah.
And if I wasn't, or if I wasn't close, or if I felt like I didn't have the energy to push through, then I didn't find it that attractive to, you know, continue being 200 or 180 and fighting that battle. And I felt like, you know, other parts of life could be important.
Yeah.
And it could be a very important part of my journey moving forward.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was that decision. It wasn't, it was well thought out.
Yeah.
It felt sudden, but I feel like it was well thought out.
Yeah, I don't think you're a rash person. That's one thing I've noticed as our little buddy joins us here. Somdev, my daughter is 7, and she refers to Noah as the little guy as well. So, okay. I mean, that should tell you something. We're just talking about the end of his career and how he came to that decision, Noah. So welcome to the podcast. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. so you're talking a little bit about how hungry you were as a player and how that just kind of dwindled. Is that hunger, is that something that you, especially now as a coach, can you teach that, or is that innate just in your body, or is it natural, or can it be taught?
I think it's more natural. I think it can be taught. I think it can be encouraged. But I think, I mean, Noah, I'd love to hear your take on this. But, you know, I think a big part of that is natural. Mm. You know, I mean, I for me, I remember stories when I was a kid growing up. You know, when we would leave the courts, would be when we couldn't see the ball anymore, because we didn't have lights. And when we could see the ball, we were at the courts at 5 a.m. Because it got too hot to play, you know, growing up where I did. And we had school and other things. And so, you know, I was talking to Donskoy just last week.
Yeah.
And he gave me a great story about Rublev. He said, you know, once Rublev had a stress fracture on his back, and the doc said, you know, this could be dangerous. Don't get out there and play. Take 2 weeks off. And he takes a day off, takes 2 days off, and they come back to the academy, and Rublev is, they hear these sounds, and Rublev is smashing balls on the wall. because for him, it was, you know, it's not that people are forcing him to work hard.
Yeah.
It's just innate that this is what he wants to do, and I'm not sure that he wants to do anything else, you know? One of the things I look at players these days, I feel like they don't spend as much time on a court as maybe we used to. The game has changed, obviously. But that being said, I feel like, you know, the cool, I mean, listen, for me growing up, we didn't have the greatest, I mean, all due respect to my coaches, we didn't have the greatest technology or, you know, the ways that we could, you know, try and improve and have that kind of focused development. So what we had was TV. We didn't have YouTube either.
Right.
So we had TV. We had the Chennai Open. And the second we saw something on TV, we were like, I can't wait to go and try that. And so when we had, that's the only thing we had to learn. We would look at these books and magazines and try and see the way people were trying to serve and, you know, 3 tips to improve your forehand. And and we were those guys that actually went out and did that because we didn't have anything else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the balls we played with were, I mean, skinny.
Yeah.
Skinny in 20 minutes or, you know, punctured in 25. And so we didn't have scope to complain. So when we got court time, we were like, why would we not play?
Yeah.
You know, keep in mind, there were I grew up on 2 courts with about 60 kids. So the second you had time on a court, you would go out there and play. And a lot of times now I see that there are plenty of courts, plenty of time. And I'm not saying structure is bad, but I think kids need to just go out there and play a lot.
I do think I think most of it is natural. I do think that things can be self-taught. I don't know if it could come from an outside source. Me, like many other players, have gone through these ups and downs of wanting it or not. And I think nobody can get you out on that court if you don't want to get out on that court.
Exactly.
But I saw that change in me this year where I was like, there's a different feeling. Like, I want to be out here. I want to be out here an extra hour, an extra few balls. I want to, you know, do dead ball after I play 2 sets. You know, little things like that, where nobody's really encouraging that, but it was a change from what I was used to 2 years ago. But again, I still had that natural idea of, I want to be out here, I want to be running around. But for you, did you go through any of these ups and downs? Obviously, you had a terrific career, but and it might not have shown in the rankings, but did you go through these moments where you're like, do I want to be out here an extra hour? Is this something I really want to be doing right now?
I mean, the work wasn't the problem, you know? Noah, let's be honest. How much of that is directly correlated with results?
Yeah, a decent amount.
A decent amount,
yeah,
right?
I mean,
you know, if you feel like a good amount of it is directly correlated by results, then the results shouldn't be the thing dictating the way you work, right? So I felt like a lot of that is a little bit with understanding. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not that it's bad or good. It's just that if you're not willing to be very, very committed to your tennis career, it's the reality of it, especially for guys like you and me who didn't have the biggest weapons. And, you know,
what are you talking about?
You know, biggest weapons are the way you, the way we compete. Yeah. It's one of the biggest weapons, you know. Then I felt like it always wouldn't be unrealistic to expect us to have the same kind of results when you are that motivated. So I feel like that motivating factor is a huge weapon, maybe unseen though.
When you're working now with Sumit, what are the things, how much are you working with him mentally? How much are you working with him technique? And how do you, as you're starting this kind of coaching side, how do you kind of balance those two things with what your experience has been?
I think technique is, I honestly don't think that it's fair for a player for me to come in, because again, I'm not full time. I'm working with his team, along with his team, but we're spending about 15 to 20 weeks on the road. So I don't think it's fair for someone to come in and change something technically, because it may work great here, and in 2 weeks, if he has a doubt in his head and I'm not around, then it's just not a fair place to put a player in, you know? So I don't really want to, I don't touch the whole technique part of it, especially when it comes to hands and things like that. The technique that I will get involved in would be, you know, footwork on returns, footwork on, you know, coming back from a shot, things like that. You know, I think more of it would be, I mean, some people call it mental. I wouldn't necessarily label it that way. I think it would be the way you perceive the game, the way you look at the game, and the way you see how things are all connected in terms of, you know, let's say, I mean, again, you know, one of the things that I did not so great in my career, or one of the things that people capitalized on, was when I would hit a passive shot and I believed that I had the legs to get around it. Mm. Now, that while that could be true in many instances, and as you know, most good tennis players are stubborn. So that's the hardest bit.
Not this guy.
Yeah. Who have you been talking to? You know, I think it's about showing them that, you know, over time, once you start things in a passive way, it's possible to come back, but it's a harder thing in the long run. Mm. So if you can avoid one or two mistakes, especially early in points, it's a better way to set up the way you want to play and also the tone you want to set during a match. And I think it's things like that. It's things like, you know, a lot of it would be match management, understanding, you know, a lot of it is probably, you know, not wasting energy on things that you don't need to waste energy on, because I've always believed that there's a limited amount of energy that a player has, and the more they focus on things that they can avoid, then the less energy they have to focus on the things that they need to. So a lot of it is just that, but honestly, with anybody I would work with, you know, I think 2-3 weeks is, you know, we're not magicians out here. Even if you do have a good result every 2-3 weeks, you know, sometimes we see that, you know, players come in working with a new coach and boom, they have a result.
Right.
Over a period of time, I think is how you'll be able to see the impact that a coach can have on a player. And I do think that coaches can have a very healthy, positive impact on players if they all work together as a team. Noah, I want to ask you this. How much of an impact...
He's a broadcaster.
He is.
How much of an impact can the best coach have on a player, in your opinion?
So I'm actually working with somebody new this week. I mean, I've known him for about 15 years, but kind of starting again with him. And I think it kind of comes around to, there's a comfort level. You know, if you have that comfort level, if you're out there, you know, we know how uncomfortable tennis can be as a whole. So if you're there, if you're on your court and you're trusting yourself, and maybe that coach put together that one last piece that kind of, you know, wasn't anything groundbreaking, but it was just enough for you to be like, oh, okay, I feel okay right now. Who knows? That's why I think some of these results come early. And that's why I think some of these results can come in 2 or 3 weeks. But at the same time, it doesn't always sustain throughout a few months, because, again, it's not groundbreaking. You're still the tennis player you were 2 weeks ago. So those things are going to come up again. But I'm curious for you. I did this. I felt it a little bit when I was giving some lessons in New York. not necessarily that you're going to come back and play, but are there things like you're learning about your own game now because you're seeing it from a different perspective? Is that possible?
100%. Yeah. Undoubted. And I've actually given a few of my coaches a call and I've apologized. I called Scott McCain and I said, I now see what you were saying with this aspect.
Or, I'm never going to do that.
That's accurate.
Yeah.
And I called a couple of my other coaches as well. And I said, yeah, I think you were right. I just
give me one example.
I mean, one thing was, you know, sooner, not harder. You know, because taking the ball sooner takes away time, and if you take away time, you know, take away 3 feet this way, 3 feet that way, it's 6 feet. So you don't have to hit the ball necessarily harder. You have to hit the ball sooner, for which you have to have certain things, you know. And I think one of the mistakes that I made, because a lot of it was my own problems, you know, is I felt like I wasn't hitting the ball hard enough, which was true at many times, but not when you're trying to take the ball earlier. And obviously you need to develop a certain skill for it, but you know, I would always take it earlier, hit it harder, miss it just long, or you know, two, three feet long, and be like, why? And I was like, not harder, sooner. And it took me a while and it's simple now, you know, in hindsight everything's 20/20, but that's one example. I think another one would be you know, to I guess sometimes on returns, again, too passive on returns, and again, you know, when you're playing at the highest level, breaking a guy twice in a match is hard.
Yeah.
You know, people don't realize that breaking a guy 2-3 times in a match is hard. And if you're getting broken, then, you know, do the math. But yeah, sometimes I would get frustrated because I didn't get the result I wanted, especially with, say, taking a return early and, you know, putting him on defense earlier on a second serve return, or finding the balance between going up and back, something like that. But yeah, you know, just not being able to see long term that if you're playing in a certain pattern and you're playing, you know, you're winning 6 points and losing four, that's a great strategy. 60% is, anybody it's will take
good.
That, you know, but it's hard to see when you've lost four and you aren't able to look at past those 10 points. You can't look at the big picture. Sometimes as a player, it's hard to see that. And sometimes as a coach, it can be frustrating if we're not on the same page with communication.
You mentioned a little while ago, right before Noah got here, when you were talking about the end of your career, that you didn't want to do it if you were in that 180, 200 range, and you just didn't want to grind that out. There's obviously been a lot of talk over the last 6 months with Andrea Gaudenzi making the comment about how challenger life should be like a university and you should be graduating pretty quickly. And it just kind of brought up the talk about, can we have sustained financial comfort at this level, about 180, 200? And I'm just wondering, now that you are past it a couple years and coming back from a different perspective, is that realistic to think that somebody who's 200 in the world can have financial stability, and what do we need to achieve that so that the challenger level is healthy?
I mean, if that's not realistic, then what are the people doing in order to make it realistic?
Yeah.
You know, I think it's, maybe we should get Noah in on this.
I talk too much about that. You know, my opinion.
He's gotten in enough trouble on that.
I mean, trouble is one thing, you know, but I think we should be finding a way to, you know, make good professional tennis players making more money. The truth is, they are making more money now than they were 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I joke about it with Sumit now that, you know, the first time I played the Open, it really wasn't that long ago, 2009. I graduated and, you know,
like 40 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. you know, qualied, won a round, lost second round. I think it was 25 or 26, something along those lines, you know, that I picked up, which I was really happy with at the time. I was very happy with at the time.
So sorry to hear that.
Yeah. And now you look at it and, you know, 60 grand for showing up, close to 100 for winning.
Yeah.
And they still have more complaints, you know. Mm-hmm. So the truth is that if you look back, there are improvements, you know, but I still feel like there could be more.
Yeah,
you know, I don't see why that's a bad thing. Why would you, as a tennis player, one of the basic principles that you live by, is you continuously work on your game regardless of where you reach. You know, You look at guys like, you know, the top guys. I mean, people use them as examples all the time. But I don't think work ever stops.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it's one thing to say, okay, you know, I'm happy with what I've done. But I think when you're a professional at something, especially in an aspiring sport like tennis, the principle is you never stop trying to find different ways to improve. You know, so, yes, I think tennis players should be making more money. Undoubtedly, I think there's several ways that they could go about it. I think it's healthy to be self-critical and find ways to get better. I honestly don't know any other way to do it.
Yeah.
Personal question. You can answer this, you know, in whatever way you want to. But post-career, how did you feel financially? Were you okay after the work that you put in, being one of the best tennis players in the world for an extended period of time? Did you feel like you got your due after that time?
I never felt like I was due anything.
It's too nice of a guy. We can't.
No, let me answer. Yeah. Like you know, one thing is I never felt like I had lavish taste, you know. So I wasn't into, you know, buying the $10,000 watch or buying a $100,000 car. It didn't matter to me. I got a second-hand Honda Civic when I moved back to India because I felt like it made sense. Mm. And it didn't bother me at all that I drove it, you know. By the way, a Honda Civic in India is looked at very differently than a Honda Civic in America, just to be clear about that. I felt like in that sense, could I have had more? Could I have, undoubted. I feel like one of the places where the ATP fell short, and I actually discussed this with them. I don't know how deep in the house that discussion is going to go, but I felt like one of the things where they've lacked very hard was helping the players progress to whatever the next move was going to be, you know. And I felt like, in a sense, you know, apart from the pension, which a handful of players get. Even that is very, you know, it could be better. Let's just say that. Right. I think apart from that, and honestly, I wasn't qualified for pension. I only made 4 years, and then did nothing about it. And a few years later, I got a message that, hey, you still get something, and I was like, oh, cool. You know? So it felt like I was playing with house money there. But did I feel financially secure? Yes, because I never felt like I wanted
more,
that much more, and I never felt like I needed that much more in order to live.
Yeah,
you know, would I have been happier with more? Yes, no question about it. And I think that I was lucky. Let me just give you a couple examples. You know, I was lucky because I felt like I had a university backing me up. I had a network of people backing me up. You know, Tony Bresky, who you know so well. Yeah. People like that guiding me. I mean, a lot of that I felt like was, you know, having good conversations with the right people where you felt like they have your best interest at whatever it is the next step of your life needs to be. You know, it could be coaching, which I have no problem with, but it shouldn't be coaching due to lack of choices,
right?
You know, I dabbled with, organizations and seeing how they wanted to, you know, build a facility, something with India, with Olympians, with building sport culture, with a lot of different things, with schools, with colleges, with having better events, building a structure, a culture towards training. So all of that stuff was fun, but I also felt like I didn't get any support, you know. And one thing I feel like, I don't know if a lot of players feel this, is when you leave, it takes about 8 months to a year till you feel like you're an outsider. You know, I don't know about how other players feel. This is how I felt. And I'm not necessarily sure that that's a good thing. You know, considering I put 8-10 years into a professional career and, you know, apart from a random email about, you know, your alumni benefits, which, you know, I wasn't going to go to the resort in Spain.
Few and far between. Yeah.
Or get the free, not free, but, you know, discount on the golf clubs. You know, apart from that, I never felt like, I never felt included with the ATP. I remember going to a few tournaments a couple times and actually having trouble with badges. despite being an alumni member, and nobody really knew that alumni member can actually get badges. And so then, you know, you do it the simple way, which is, you know, every second person on the tour, so you ask someone for a badge and someone says yeah. But I yeah. never felt like that was the right way to go about it.
Yeah,
you know, so in that sense I feel like and keep in mind I feel like I still had a good network of people because of prior pro, and you know, felt like I had a good relationship with guys. How would the guy ranked 150 or, you know, 170 feel if who didn't go to college
yeah.
feel if they left the tour? I feel like they would feel alone.
Yeah, I mean, you're personable, you're easy to talk to. I think there's a lack of understanding of how important networking is during this time. I mean, you know, if anything else, we're meeting some of the most powerful and wealthy and affluent people in the world. And I think a lot of players here can attest that it's not their priority. I mean, their priority is hitting a tennis ball, of course. But I think there's a lack of understanding of how important that is, just to kind of, you know, a conversation here and there to set you up for... Oh. Yeah. As he gets the ball,
it's a man who can never stop. Like he's in the middle of like saying some of his answers, and he's just watching tennis right behind.
No, always making something up. Yeah. But I think there's just a lack of understanding of just how important it is to make those connections and to meet those people. And that's you're saying of how important that is for your next step, because you know, process of elimination, they're like, I guess I'm going to coach tennis. What else am I going to do? You know, yeah. I'm speaking to South Americans. That is their first answer right off the bat. A lot of the Europeans the same way. So you, I think, are kind of in that 1% that you were set up regardless.
I agree.
Do you see that with some of your other friends of like, I didn't know what they were going to do kind of thing?
Completely agree.
Yeah.
Exactly. That was, you know, that was kind of the point I was trying to make as well. You know, let's say, for example, you want to set up a tennis academy.
Yeah.
You know, I think there could be ways for a former pro, if he wants to set up a tennis academy, to have some sort of affiliations and some sort of push from the tour to set it up better. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, you know, I'll tell you this out of experience. You know, setting up a tennis academy and, you know, making good profits out of it is not the hardest thing to do. At the same time, but the problem still remains that if a guy that's 250 comes in, you know, let's say that you're a tennis academy in Europe and you're making whatever X amount from a junior player, but the pro can't afford to pay you, but all your energy and effort is going towards the pro. So the coach is now at a little bit of a dilemma, because they're not sure because what's more exciting, obviously, to get this kid to qualify the US Open and play Roger first round, which is what happened with Sumit a couple of years ago, which was amazing.
Yes.
You know, took a set off Roger, and, you know, that kind of puts a little bit of wind under your behind your sails to kind of keep you going. But the reality of it is also that, you know, one player that's ranked at that level can't afford to pay you. And we know this because we've all played the game. And your academy needs to continuously function, mm-hmm. because you have investors, and B, you have employees, and it needs to function at a certain standard and quality. So I feel like now, is that getting better or not? I don't think it is, you know, and I think that's a problem that tennis has had for a very long time, is that the recreational side of the game is much more lucrative than the professional side. So if a professional player has to make a rational choice of what they want to go towards, if they want to stick to the pros, it's a hard one.
I just think the outsider discussion that you brought up is extremely disappointing for anybody to listen to. I mean, how much you put into the sport, your ranking, where you were for 4 years, and to feel like you were almost never a part of the sport to begin with, like, yeah, poof, I'm gone, it's out of there, I think it's disheartening. But that's how Mike feels.
Yeah, Mike, well, let me ask you guys a question. You guys have been around... doing this a little bit more. Let's say you wanted to host a challenger. Or let's say you wanted to host a 250.
Those players suck. Why would I ever host that?
Like, how, realistically, how much time would it take to be able to do that? And how hard is it to jump through those loopholes or rather follow the right protocol and still do it?
I know financially, the typical... thought process is you need whatever the prize money is, you need 3x.
Okay.
So that's what you're looking at financially. So then it becomes how quickly can you, at least at the challenger level, right? How quickly can you raise that money?
Right.
Because there are, ATP wants to put on those events. USTA here in the States, they're looking for places to put on the events. Different beast, obviously, at the ATP when you have licenses and all that, that kind of stuff. But it just really truly depends on how quickly you can get that financial backing.
Yeah, I mean, I was working on some of the events that I was working on, and then also talking to, like, Kerry,
yeah,
you know, that has a lot of challengers there. And it was, it just seemed like the turnover for sponsorship, and that was what I was dealing with as well, is just like, oh, we're on board, and tomorrow, we're not really feeling it right now, because it was just kind of a free-for-all. So I think it was really difficult to get that, you know, group of sponsors that would stick with you through the challenger circuit. I mean, you know, we saw what happened in the pandemic. You know, challengers were just thrown to the wayside. A lot of these sponsors were like, we don't have the money. You guys are the first person that we're, you know, we're going to say no to. So whether it was like a Binghamton or anything, you know, it was a quick no. So, it's, you know, it's because, just like anything else, the top of the sport is where the money goes. And I think a lot of people know that, and they want their sponsors, you know, to be seen by, you know, or be worn or be next to some of the top players and most eyes possible. And that's just not the challenger tour.
I think to answer your question about how long, I mean, as I said, the answer is how quickly you can get the money. But realistically, 6 to 8 months, you could probably get a challenger futures, something along those lines. Tour level, it's a different beast.
Tour level is a different beast.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's like, why would you want to? You know, and that's the serious question. You know,
but is that the right way?
Well,
like, let's say we only said
we were going to talk for half an hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
I got dinner to catch.
Leave lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tough question. I know when we've talked about structure wise, the answer to me is no. I think we can do a lot more to make things very much more regional, so that they're much more financially viable.
Yeah.
Have a location that's willing to host a series of events. I think, I mean, we've seen that at the futures level, and Antalya has, you know, 19 futures in a row, right?
Monastir had 50.
Right. Yeah. Right. Greece, the same thing. Yeah.
But it makes some level of sense to have, you know, that financial certainty
stability
of it. Yeah. And stability is really important. And, you know, it's a tough answer. And I think the way we've structured it is not ideal.
The end is, why would you want to? You know, the one thing that comes together when we're talking to the people that have put on, you know, like a Kerry that has put it on throughout, you know, the pandemic and not making, is because they just love tennis and they really care about the players.
Exactly.
That really is what comes down to it. It's not like they're killing it.
They don't
and
need
coming
to.
Out. They don't need to.
Yeah.
Honestly, it's probably worse for them to have these events going on a lot of the time, especially for a nice club like this to give away this many courts and to have these players, you know. But, you know, people like coming and watching the tennis. I'm not making real money from this. It's not real. So it's, you know, like we said, if it could help, you know, the community around it and be a little bit more local, that's where I think,
the prize
can real come. But it's going to take some time. I don't know if it's ever going to happen. So
we're going to let you go. But last night when I confirmed that we were actually going to sit down and do this, I had to go back and I looked. And sure enough, you were participating in the first challenger I ever broadcast.
Which one was that?
Winnetka 2013.
Oh, 2013.
That was my first ever.
Did I lose to Jack Sock in the semis?
That is correct.
Yeah, that was so quick.
Yeah, 7-6 in the third. I think I was, I don't remember exactly, but I know I had a lead in the third.
Okay.
I think it was 76 degrees, I believe. That, was
that I can't remember.
No, I will say this funny story about that, though. Yeah. I was really mad at Jack. Because
add your name to the list.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It adds up.
No. I was mad at him for a different. We were playing doubles that week, and we actually made finals. We lost to Yuki and Venus. I think 10-8.
Okay.
10-8 in the. Why do I remember this stuff? but yeah, playing Jack in the semis of Winnetka, and I'd beaten him on grass a few weeks before that in Nottingham, I think. So and that one he should have won. He was up 6-2, 6-1, 5-2. One break.
Wow.
One break. But, you know, grinded that one out.
Yeah.
And so I'm playing Jack in the semis, and it is hot as hot can be. And it's India hot, you know. And Jack was dying. And I think in the middle of the second set, I was up a set and a break. In the middle of the second set, he said his clothes were soaked. And he went and took like a 10, 12-minute like Tsitsipas bathroom break.
Yeah.
I was livid.
Yeah.
Because I was like, this is not fair. Because,
comes
you know,
back a new person.
Comes back a new person. And, you know, this is not fair. And I've always felt that, you know, maybe I'm biased and probably am. Because I was like, you know, fitness is one of my strengths.
Yes.
So if I'm out-fitnessing you in a match, that's your problem.
Yeah.
I've actually
that's
worked.
The point.
That's the whole point of what I'm trying to do over here. If I'm, and you don't want to be here mentally or physically. And then he came back a new person. Still feel like I should have won. I don't remember, but I had a big, big lead. But 7-6 in the third. But yeah, I'm glad I gave you some entertainment.
Well, the night before, I don't remember your match, and I'm sure that that's everything you just said is complete. The night before was the Bogomolov, when he walked off in the middle. When he walked off the middle of against Klon.
Yeah,
you remember that?
I kind of do.
He just left.
It was like because a call or something, and he
there was a call that had come from the stands, and he just walked off.
Yeah, I remember that.
It was just like what.
I remember that.
This is going to be a fun career that I've gotten myself into.
No, but Mike, I was actually talking about when we confirmed this last night, Trett and I were having dinner, Trett Huey. And one of the things we actually talked about was, again, just talking about how we could, the broader picture.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I really appreciate about you and watching Challenger matches in the States is I feel like people who are in this are all in.
Yes.
You know, and when we were watching you, it's not generic. It's not, oh, another cross, a beautiful drop shot, or a great serve. You know, there's like, what's happening behind this? What's the game within the game? Let me see how insightful I could be while giving out information. And as I'm in broadcasting right now, I can tell you that when you're doing this without a co-commentator, it is incredibly hard.
Yes.
Because who do you feed off of? And then why shouldn't there be a second opinion? And sometimes you do, but you can't kind of. So, Mike, what I'm trying to say is thank you.
Oh, that's
thank
you, kind of
you. Because I do think that having, you know, like just like you said, like having more people, having people host tournaments who actually want to host tournaments makes a tournament good. And having a person be a commentator or do a podcast who actually wants to do it makes it, adds that special value to whatever it is that, you know, we're doing and even to the listeners. So thank you for your time. It's 2013, nice 9 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully in 9 more, we're talking more tennis stories, man.
Well, if I hit, I'll be retirement age.
Yeah.
That'll
still
be great.
A piece of shit.
retirement, I mean.
Was that last year for me? What's happening?
Sometimes I can't believe when I'm on air, I can't believe I come off and I'm like, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this.
Is it great, right?
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
I
mean, so
I talk about how lucky I am all the time. This is exactly what I wanted to do when I was 15.
Yeah.
So he knew he wanted
a
to be with
sarcasm.
Me.
I wanted to be a co-host.
Samdev, thank you. It's really a pleasure to see you back. And as I said, I mean, he's got these shoes on, which he's had on for forever.
Oh, my God.
The Virginia shirt. Like, he hasn't changed.
No.
Yeah. Hasn't changed.
Just the hair.
Just the hair.
Just the
a
hair.
A little longer.
Just, yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
The show might be over, but the conversation isn't. Join us on social media at NoahRubin33, at MikeCTennis, and at Behind the Racket.
Expect new episodes every Monday or Tuesday. And don't forget to leave us a rating on iTunes. It really helps us expand and reach more listeners as we take you behind the racket.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.